It's history.
If we dig deep in our history and our documents, and remember that we are not descended from fearful men.
It's hardcore history.
Today's show took a long time to finish, but it turned out to be a good thing. It allowed me to remind myself what the parameters and the point of hardcore history is. I think we've gotten caught up in some narrative history shows recently where you talk about events in linear order. There's nothing wrong with that, and I want to be able to do that from time to time. But today's topic reminded me that I want to be able to break out of that mold whenever I want to. You know, I have this topic that's fascinating, a fascinating story, and yet every time I would start to tell it to you, I would talk about ideas that popped into my head about the story rather than the story itself. And after wrestling with this a while, I just realized, wait a minute, giving in to the urges to talk about all these little tangents is kind of what this program is about. So if you don't learn enough about the topic that I was going to talk to you about, and still will to some degree, pick up a book. We are a bunch of history fans discussing history over coffee, geeking out on history. And so sometimes I find the weird little side angles as interesting or more interesting than the story itself, which is a big thing because this story is fascinating. Let me tell you what weird angle, though, the whole thing boiled down to in my head, and I can't get past it, and it's a weird subject to be thinking about. Are white people special? And I couldn't think of a decent way to say that, so I just thought I'd say it and live with the consequences, because asking a question like, are white people special, is a good way to get yourself, thought of as, you must be a high-ranking member of the intellectual wing of the Ku Klux Klan to say something like that. But when looking at the story I want to talk to you about today, that's an assumption that's been built into that story for a long time. And while it's tough for us to discuss today, after all, race is full of minefields and ramifications, and when people talk about differences between people that might be racial in nature, people freak out. And understandably so. I mean, someone wants to do a study on maybe the different capabilities of the different races. That has real-world ramifications that affects people in lots of ways. So you can understand why it's a big deal. But what it makes you wonder about is how will a lot of these things we look at through our current prism look different once that prism is gone? Case in point, you know, one of these days, we're all going to be tan. How is this going to look then? Let me back up and explain what I mean. There was a conference I went to once where one of these people speaking was explaining, I forgot what he was, an anthropologist or something like that, and he was explaining some of the theories on what's thought of as the future of the human race. What will we look like in a couple thousand years? And one of the theories he threw out there was that the differences between people's races will disappear, that over time, through things like intermarriage and whatnot, we are going to become more of a monochrome kind of tannish species, and that these stark differences between white and Asian and black and African, all these different, differences we've lived with for a long time, will go away. And all I could think about was, okay, then in the history books in those times, when they're looking back on, the history we're all used to looking back on, how are they going to treat race? It's the same thing I thought of when I was watching one of these shows on TV the other night that was talking about UFOs and whether the Earth has been visited by aliens. And it purports to show what a bunch of different alien types are that people have run into. So they have a sketch artist draw the gray one, and the gray ones have these qualities, I was told on this TV show. And then there's the green ones, and the green ones have these other qualities. And it's funny because it's almost like the galaxy's version of, different human races. But the difference is because we're not concerned about all of the stuff that hangs over racial questions, you were free to speculate about the different qualities. Well, the brown ones are like this, and the gray ones are like this, and the green ones are like that. Maybe somewhere down the road, 3 millennia from now, our tannish descendants will be able to do the same, and will wonder about what the differences meant. I mean, you're going to look at history, and you're going to look at this era I want to talk about, which is known, by the way, as the age of exploration or the age of discovery, and you're going to wonder 3,000 years from now if there was something special about white people. These white human beings took over the world in a about 100 years, held it for a long time, and kept all these darker peoples down. Professor, what was it about these white people that made them different? That's a question that will not have the overtones it has now. The person asking that question and the person answering that question will have no fear about being seen as a, you know, KKK intellectual. But it's worth asking, because if you look at the stuff I want to talk about today, the two old ways this stuff was taught totally bought into the idea that white people were special. Doesn't mean they're wrong, by the way, either. This is maybe the most controversial part of this whole thing. But special doesn't always mean special good. Special can also mean special bad. For a long time, I mean, especially in the era of colonialism in the late 1800s and stuff, but you could get fumes of this even in textbooks that I got when I was in grade school that were leftovers from the late 50s and early 60s. The portrayal of things like Columbus's expedition, the age of exploration, the European takeover of the world from that period, all that was portrayed in a light that suggested that the reasons Europeans did this was because there was something special about them. And some of the texts you read insinuate that maybe it was the Christianity, others that maybe it was a natural intrepidness. There was all kinds of things, but you would look at it today and think that these things looked racist. The white man's burden and all that stuff, right? Why does the European spread over the earth and conquer and civilize all these darker peoples? Well, it's God's way. White man's burden. And so there was this idea once upon a time, and the way this story was portrayed is the reason that white people had dominion over all these other races was because they were special, special good. Now, when the late 60s rolled around, in the early 70s, you had revisionist historians looking at this same story, the age of exploration, through the totally opposite lens. They were looking at it through the perspective of the people who were discovered, not the people who did the discovering. And the story looked very different from that viewpoint, obviously. First of all, it still held the same basic idea that white people were special, but they were special bad. There was something particularly evil about white folks, white society, European culture, whatever it was. Different people had different theories, but you could look at comments by people like Susan Sontag and a million other people from the intellectual 1960s, and that same idea that white people were specifically different than other folks was still, you know, as strong as it ever was. It had just totally flipped to the other side of the coin. I remember reading one thing that was talking about how white society had been destroyers ever since the time of the Indo-European invasions going back to the age of the chariots, you know, 1200 BCE. That the combination of rapacious white folks with rapacious Christianity the whole idea was that somehow they were extra specially bad and they did things that other people wouldn't do. And once again, it was because there was something different about them. Now, fast forward to now, where we have a more synthesized view of this whole thing, just like we do about most subjects, yet this one still remains really controversial. And it remains really controversial in a way that most historical stories don't. If I talk to you about the Greek and Persian Wars, if I talk to you about Rome and Carthage, if I talk to you about the Japanese invasion of Korea in the 1500s, well, actually that one might be one of the other examples, you don't get that upset. You're not involved emotionally, doesn't have any real-world ramifications for you. But just look at the protests we see in U.S. cities every time it's Columbus Day. And you can see that the whole age of exploration thing still makes people angry and arouses the passions. And part of the reason why is this unspoken, you know, white people particularly evil kind of thing. So let's talk a little bit about this. I mean, I want to talk about Magellan, but Magellan's just a piece of this larger story, which is the old world finding the new world and what happens when globalization 1.0, as I like to call it, takes hold. Magellan's the guy, by the way, who did that. First man to circumnavigate the globe, you know, sail around the earth. Actually, that's the question you have to put on your history test to get the answer right. But it's a little controversial because Magellan died on the way around the world. So how he gets credit for being the first guy around the world is a little, let's just say, controversial, in Spain especially. Now, he didn't make it around the world because he died in the Philippine Islands, which he became, I believe he was the first European to touch the shores of the Philippines. He would never leave alive. He got involved in the local politics there, started spreading some Christianity, did some things he shouldn't have in terms of exceeding the goals of his mission and his mandate, and was cut up in knee-deep turquoise water in what must have been a tropical paradise by the natives of Mactan Island in the Philippines. Hundreds of years later, in the 1860s, the Queen of Spain puts up a memorial to Magellan. Very loyal thing to do, but after all, she pretty much owed her country's position in the world to Magellan and several other intrepid men who basically got it for them. There's really 15 or 20 guys in the Age of Exploration that literally turned the world on its head. Magellan was one of them. So the Queen of Spain in the 1860s puts a monument up near where he died to his memory. And of course, this was in a country that Spain happened to be the colonial rulers of when she put that memorial up there. And when the Filipinos got the chance to put their own monument up about a century later, they put up a monument commemorating that very same event right next to the Queen of Spain's monument. And it wasn't a monument to the guy who died in the service of Spain, cut up in the knee-deep turquoise water. It was a monument to the guy who killed him. That shows you how the age of discovery and exploration looks very different depending on which angle you're examining it from. To the Filipinos, these were white European Christians who were invading their country. And yet there are Christian Filipinos today because they showed up. The real-world ramifications of these events from 500 years ago are still with a lot of these people in, you know, well, all over the world. Globalization 1.0 changed everything. And it easily could have gone another way. Globalization was going to happen, and countries were going to find each other, and the world was going to connect. But that it would be Europeans who would be the driving force behind it, and therefore the beneficiaries, seems a real long shot in the era where it happens. The Age of Discovery runs from about the 1400s to about the, well, 17. In the 1700s, the major stuff starts tapering down. You have people exploring the Arctic and everything a long time after that. But the major era where the world gets turned on its head and Europeans become the top dog on the planet happens in the 1400s, 1500s, and 1600s. But if you had been a betting person, and you were betting who was going to be the first people to circumnavigate the globe, the odds-on favorite would have had to have been the Chinese. In the 1400s, when Henry the Navigator in Portugal is like the guy who discovers the internet 10 years before it takes off, and he's in Portugal getting all the people who know anything about cartography and sailing and map-making together at conferences, and he's sending out expeditions to, you know, places right by Portugal, like Northwest Africa, and he's losing expedition after expedition after expedition, sinking. The Chinese are traveling, you know, halfway around the world. Where the Europeans throw three or four little ships that are less than a third the size of a World War II destroyer out there to face the oceans, the Chinese treasure fleets in the 1400s sometimes have hundreds of ships. And they're giant ships, ships the Europeans won't match until the 1800s. And they're so sophisticated that the Chinese have several ships that go out in these fleets with nothing but topsoil on them so that they can grow some citrus-type fruits along the way for these long voyages so that the sailors don't get scurvy. And sailors? These fleets sometimes had 25,000 men in them. It's not hard, even though it seems wild, to imagine the French or English, Spanish or Portuguese waking up one morning in the 1400s and seeing hundreds of Chinese ships out in their harbor, the Chinese having sailed the other way around the world, discovered the Americas en route, and now were showing up to say hi to the Europeans while the Europeans were in the high Middle Ages. Think about how history would have been different. And if it hadn't been the Chinese, the Arabs would have been your next best bet because they were amazing seafarers. They were spreading Islam everywhere they went, and they had penetrated all the way to what would be, you know, the area around Indonesia today. And had the Arabs been the first ones to make it around the world, or the Turks, when Columbus found the New World, he might have found mosques along the coastline. Once again, think of how that would have changed history. But the part that wouldn't have changed is what would have happened to the native civilizations in the Americas. I think, once again, those who think that there was something extra special bad about the white European civilizations think that things might have been different had the Europeans never found them. It's interesting to think about what would have happened in North and South America had they not contacted the rest of the world until the 20th or the 21st century. What would they have been like, you know, by now had they been allowed to develop? Or what would they have been like had, instead of the rapacious Christian white conquerors found them, the Chinese or the Arabs had gotten there first? The Muslims, for example, had gone to many of these places in Indonesia, and they had not conquered by the sword, had not raped and destroyed the populations the way that had happened in the New World. They had simply spread their religion. They traded with these people. Maybe that's what life would have been like had they discovered the New World first. Maybe you didn't have to have the Cortezes and the Pizarros and the raping and the conquering of the native peoples and the destructions of the Aztec and Inca empires and all that. And the Chinese, some historians believe the Chinese did make it to the Americas, came over, traded some things, said they'd be back and left. And it should be noted that the reason the Chinese maybe didn't do all these things that they would the odds on favor to do is because China is sort of schizophrenic when it comes to sea travel. You'd get an emperor who was really interested in it, and he'd spend half his life building up the resources and the fleet and everything, and the second half of his life, you know, taking the treasure fleet, for example, all over the area around China and doing great things, and then he would die and his successor would come into power and it'd be some internal Confucian-oriented person who would not care about sea travel and they'd let the fleet rot and everything and you'd have to wait till another dynasty to go exploring. So it was a much broken up history of sea travel for the Chinese. So there are reasons why maybe the Chinese weren't the first ones to circumnavigate the globe. But I think we can all agree that someone was going to do it and some civilization was going to unite the planet, map the major civilizations and cultures, and pierce the veil that kept these worlds apart from each other. And this veil was so significant that when the Old World and the New World, using parentheses with my fingers, the New World, when they first connect with each other, you have the most massive transfer of biological species and flora and fauna, or one of the most significant transfers in all human history. Everything from plants to animals to viruses begin making their way, you know, between the two areas. Same thing would have happened had the Chinese or the Arab civilizations or any other civilization pierced that veil. And the native civilizations in the Americas, for some reason, got the worst end of that deal. Once the Old World and New World got hooked up, the Old World transferred millennia's worth of viruses across this new connection. And it destroyed the New World. You only had to look back 100 years, 150 years, to see Europe literally decimated, the population, you know, cut down by a huge amount by a single virus. The Black Plague. When the connection was made between, you know, the New and the Old World, the New World got all of Europe's big viruses that had been accrued over wave after wave after wave of epidemics going back millennia in one fell swoop. It was like a giant Pandora's box was brought over on a ship and opened up, and everything Europe had managed to throw together, virally speaking, in its whole history. And Asia, too. Remember, this is the Old World is everywhere else. And then you bring it to the New World. And the native populations were decimated worse than anything the Europeans had seen during the bubonic plague era. As a matter of fact, there's no real way to know how bad it was because it literally swept into the interior of the New World to places where Europeans weren't. The viruses went. By the time Europeans found these places, all they saw was what was left over after the viruses had done their work, and sometimes their work had been kill 2/3 of the population. By the time Europeans found the rest of the interior of the New World, they found the post-European virus New World. They never saw the pre-European virus New World. The damage done to the native societies that were discovered during the age of exploration are undeniable. They are catastrophic, and the salt was rubbed in the wound because there were sometimes centuries of colonialization and domination afterwards. In the case of some of the native peoples in the Americas, they never recovered, obviously. So you can understand why people would be upset and protest on Columbus Day. I think where I disagree with these protesters, though, is there's something implied in their chastisement that somehow we would handle things so much better today. And I wonder about that. And I had a dream once that sort of made me think about this. And the dream is that one of the great scientific powers here on Earth, Japan, the United States, China, Russia, whatever, launches a new satellite into space. And the satellite is exponentially better than anything that's up there now. The best satellite ever. And the first thing it does to prove that it was worth the money is find an island in one of the world's major oceans that had somehow eluded detection, you know, all these years. GPS, Polynesians looking for islands, you know, the Great White Fleet of Teddy Roosevelt. Doesn't matter. No one's ever found it before. You wake up tomorrow morning, that's on all the news stations and the internets. And what's more, the island is a decent size, maybe something like one of the Hawaiian islands. And the biggest news of all is it has people on it. A couple of thousand tribal folks in a pre-modern society that have no idea that there even is an outside world. How exciting and fun and interesting and different would that be? And just to make the situation a little bit more apropos and a little bit more sticky and a little bit more representative of this era we're talking about, just imagine that this satellite that found this new island that had never been discovered also finds that it's sitting atop the largest remaining supply of crude oil left on the planet. How do you think we are going to handle this, and we being the rest of the world? What do you think happens 24 hours after this major new discovery happens? Because this really goes to the heart of the issue about how should people have handled the discovery of major new territories that they didn't know existed and that had extreme value to them. How would we handle it? Well, I see it going a couple of different ways. Being the ex-news reporter I am, I see the world's global press descending on this island within 24 hours of hearing the news. I see helicopters, I see telephoto lenses, I see reporters eager to be the first news person ever to do a live stand-up from the beach at Island X. And all you have to imagine is that the chocolate and cigarettes that the reporter hands out to the little native children already begin the corruption of the island's, you know, natural culture. The scientists are also going to want to go there, aren't they? They're going to rush over there to study this population that's uncorrupted. What a wonderful chance to do something modern science has rarely, if ever, had the chance to do. See a sizable population that's totally uncorrupted by modernity. They're going to want to get in there. Once again, though, you have that contact beginning between this old society living its traditional ways and the rest of us contaminating them to a degree. Then the humanitarians are going to want to come in, aren't they? We have children here who could be, you know, vaccinated against what the scientists and reporters are probably bringing into their culture. Medicine, food, blankets. What do these people need? We're going to have some people come over and try to help them. And of course, there might be a few quiet groups who go in there and try to culturally buff some of the rough edges off of these people's traditional ways. Maybe they have a little tradition of, you know, ritual cannibalism or something. We'll get some modern 21st century types in there and say, you know, you gotta give that up. Maybe that's the 21st century version of evangelists going into their culture and telling them that some of the ugly sides of it can be trimmed up before the public finds out about them. before the National Geographic photographers arrive to take wonderful pictures to satisfy the curiosity the rest of us have about this wonderful new people, while at the same time corrupting them. And this, of course, completely ignores the factor of there being oil underneath the territory. So that's one way it could go. We could corrupt these people by accident, by accidental contact and attempts to do good things. Or maybe it goes another way. Maybe the UN steps in. Maybe they pull a page from Star Trek and they say we have to have a non-interference policy with these separate cultures, lest we destroy them. You bring these people the internet. You hook them up to electricity. You bring them into the rest of the world. You open up airports to travelers and let them travel outside that zone, and their culture will be destroyed. So we're going to create, you know, a zone and make this island off limits to protect it. Call it a global cultural heritage trust or something. My point is that it would be virtually impossible to protect the native culture that we discover tomorrow from the rest of us. And contact with the rest of us would destroy it, or at least reduce it to the same sort of cultural vanilla that countries are now. There's differences between countries, but not as big as if we had just found one yesterday. I mean, I'm pretty sure that we would do a more humane job, we modern people, than our Renaissance-era forebears at destroying this new culture, but make no mistake about it. Destroy it we will, just as effectively as the old world destroyed the culture of the new world when they found it. Now, they tried deliberately often to destroy this culture. I'm not sure even our best protective efforts would protect some newfound culture today from, you know, disintegrating just by rubbing up next to us. I would give this new island, oh, I don't know, a generation before you could find McDonald's, the internet, and see oil drilling derricks right offshore. One wonders then if the generation after that won't be shaking their fist at the rest of the world for destroying their idyllic, you know, traditional culture and leaving them in the state they're in. And if there's no way to protect a traditional culture, then one wonders how different the New World's development would have been had, instead of the Europeans find them, the Chinese found them, or the Islamic civilizations found them first. Because even if those civilizations hadn't stayed and tried to conquer, they would have brought the same diseases with them that wiped out so many of the peoples in the Americas, and they would have brought the technological changes that would have destroyed the traditional way of life. All it would have taken really are some guns traded to the tribes on the coast to send a geopolitical shockwave that was like a domino effect, totally upsetting the balance of power between all the tribes. You can see this happening later on with tribal peoples when the Maori in the modern-day New Zealand part of town get guns, and it does the same thing to their balance of power. I think once the world found itself in globalization 1.0, the native societies of the technologically inferior peoples, especially ones who are completely decimated by disease at the outset, is doomed. Of course, it didn't have to be as nasty and as rapacious as the Age of Explorer countries made it. You see, that's the other thing. We've been talking about white people as though it's a racial thing, but it may be a cultural thing. The people who came to the New World treated the native societies that they found here the same way they would treat societies in Europe. They were playing by the rules of Europe at an extremely violent and vicious time. The Middle Ages, the early Renaissance. The way they treated the Aztec empires and the Incan empires is the way that they wanted to treat the Muslim ones. The only reason they couldn't is because these Muslim ones resisted and were strong too, because they were used to fighting each other. They were developing technology in a world where they competed with one another, prompting arms races and technological achievements, because if anybody gained too much of an edge on anyone else, they would take them over. When the old world came to the new one, They had this technological edge, and they used it the same way they would have used it in the old world. What the Spanish and Portuguese and later what the French, Dutch, and British did in the colonies and territories that they found via the Age of Exploration are the same things they would have done to any other non-Christian people, and maybe the same things they would have done to other Christian people, you know, in their world. I don't see them treating the Irish all that well when they went over there. There's a lot of other examples. What's sort of ironic in my mind about the whole destruction of native cultures and the finding of the Americas and all that stuff by the Europeans is that that was actually a sidebar to the goal. It was incidental. It was never intended. And we all know this because you remember your story of Columbus in 1492. Why did he find the Americas? Because he was looking for Asia. And by the way, he went to his deathbed after three or four trips back to the New World, quotations around new, went to his deathbed thinking that he'd found Asia. And remember why he thought he was going to find Asia. They knew the world was round, right? It's a common misconception that people believed at the time it was flat. And especially people who were navigators and cartographers and people who thought about this stuff. Everyone knew the world was round. That wasn't what was important. What was important in Europe of the High Middle Ages, early Renaissance, was what does it mean if the earth is round? They're very concerned about this territory that Marco Polo wrote about. Funny how little information. It's hard for us to conceive of a time when there was so little information and knowledge that one person's travels to China and he becomes a little like Sinbad the Sailor. You never know what to believe or what not to believe. But when Marco Polo's book about his travels to China hit, you know, Europe in the, you know, early Renaissance, late Middle Ages, it causes a sensation because Europe just doesn't know about stuff. And the tales of riches of China make them desperate to get over there. See, everything they get from Asia, and they get lots of luxuries and spices and porcelains and stuff like that, but comes over a torturous land route controlled by a lot of other peoples who jack up the price of all this stuff. So by the time the Europeans get it, it's old, it's stale, it's unbelievably expensive, and, you know, they pay good gold that leaves their country and goes off somewhere else to attain these luxuries. So when these, you know, high Middle Ages, early Renaissance explorers start contemplating the fact that the earth is round, they think about the fact that Asia is so far away if you go east that doesn't it reason that it might be really, really close to us the other direction? The only problem is the other direction is dominated by this giant liquid blue desert known as the Atlantic Ocean. If Henry the Navigator can't get fleets of ships from Portugal to Northwest Africa in the 1400s, which is virtually right next door, they're sinking left and right on the way, how are they going to get across the Atlantic? And remember, they have no idea how big the Atlantic is. All they know is they send these fleets off to explore it, and they never come back. How ominous is that? Or you'll send out five ships and one ship will come staggering into port, barely afloat, you know, with the crew telling horrible tales and dying and kind of horrific, kind of daunting. Makes you think, what would it take to get you on one of those ships? Well, the motivation of the Age of Exploration is one of the interesting angles about it. See, I've thought about people like Ferdinand Magellan and Christopher Columbus and all these guys. And I've thought about what deal they were basically making in order to take all these risks that are obvious. I mean, what we admire these people for is we can't imagine taking these people's risks. I mean, these people make our modern day astronauts look positively conservative. Being a sailor in the Age of Exploration and going on some of these missions we talk about, you know, throughout history is so dangerous that, well, what would it take to get you to play a game of Russian roulette? Let's put it that way. You know what Russian roulette is, right? Some stupid person will take a pistol, put one bullet in it when it holds six, spin the chamber around so that it lands somewhere randomly, put it to their head and pull the trigger, and hope that they don't get the one bullet out of six that's in there. What would it take to get you to play a game of that? Those of you who answered, as I would, that nothing would get you to play a game of Russian roulette are, I would think, the normal ones. But those of you out there that answered the question that I just posed by saying, what would it take to get me to play a game of Russian roulette? Are the people that might have been possible candidates for mariners in the Age of Exploration. Because in my mind, that's what they were doing. They were playing Russian roulette for a lot of money. Because that's what they stood to gain. You have to think of these mariners, especially the low-level seamen, as people born into a society where they probably did not have a lot of options. This is a time when what level and class of society you're born into is still very important. If you aren't born with blue blood, haven't had the money or the background where you could get a good education, you probably didn't have a lot of options in this era in society. Especially not a lot of options if you had big dreams. To become a mariner was to take a chance. You had a good chance, if you survived and came home, of being rich. You also had a very good chance of dying. One of the authors that I read for this said that an average sailor, if he could come back with a single bag of spices from the Far East, would make enough off that single bag to buy a small home and live for the rest of his life on what he made. Magellan himself would be given islands. He was going to get to be a governor of some of these newfound lands. He was going to be able to pass those on to his kids. He was going to make a ton of money. It's Russian roulette for a lot of money. Of course, there were certainly other reasons that these people probably were induced to sign up for some of these dangerous expeditions. There are reasons that young men have always gone to sea that have nothing to do with money. There are three traditional promises that the recruiters for expeditions would use. Same three you'll probably get today if you're a prospective sailor. The first thing is, obviously, travel. You will see lots of exotic and different places away from your home if you go to sea. This may have been a very big inducement for people in the early Renaissance. Not just that, a lot of these people that went to sea were in port areas where this was what you did anyway. The people in those areas made a living from the sea, whether it was just off coasts as fishermen with nets or going farther out in the larger vessels. So become a sailor, see the world, is a recruiting benefit that has always been offered going back to ancient times. Number two is adventure. Go to sea and your boring life will be transformed into something much more unpredictable, exotic, chaotic, and you never know what might happen. The promise of adventure, always something that induces people to go to sea. The final thing is romance. Sailors are famous for being the ones who had a girl in every port, and the idea of going to sea and the exotic nature of the destinations always seem to involve romance as part of the attraction. So if you're a recruiter trying to get some young 18 or 19-year-old guys from Western Europe on your dangerous expedition, you push the chance to see foreign lands on them. You push the idea of adventure and the chance to get away from their boring, humdrum, monotonous life. Finally, you push romance. And you talk to them about what some of the other explorers have seen in places where you'll be going. For example, if I'm the recruiter, all I need is a 21st century digital photograph, National Geographic quality, of Magellan's arrival in what's now Rio de Janeiro in 1519. What happened to Magellan's fleet at that time, by the way, christened the Armada de Malacca for the Spice Islands, is one of those sorts of incidents that you wish you could have a photograph of because it's like having a photograph of an extinct species of animal. Biologists will talk about what a loss it is that this species or that species died out and we don't have it anymore. But at least they can hold out hope that the DNA from a piece of amber or something can be cloned Jurassic Park style, and they may actually still see a woolly mammoth in their lifetime. People who wish for the same things for extinct historical happenings are out of luck. We have no such options. But in 1519, when Magellan's crew arrive in the unbelievable natural harbor of Rio de Janeiro, they find throngs of naked native women swimming out into the surf toward the ships to beckon the sailors over the side for entirely X-rated reasons. This is the closest any of these people will ever come to being rock stars. That's about the modern day equivalent that I could think of. But if you're a down-and-outer in Portugal or Spain in early Renaissance times, how much of an attraction must it have been to leave your world for that? Not just that, part of the attraction of this story when you look back on it is how much of the world was there if you had the sort of personality where it sounded good to run away. Think about having a part of the world. I mean, I suppose they exist now, but not like they existed then, where you could just sit there and go, you know what? I don't like the way my life is in Europe right now or Asia right now. I'm simply leaving. I'm going to lose myself in another place and just live differently. In American history of 100 years ago, the thing that people would say is that they were going to run off to Mexico. Just get lost in some dusty Mexican town somewhere, live a totally different life. You know, go native. Well, if you didn't get killed, cut up, eaten, or something else by the natives in some of these places, this was a real possibility for a lot of these sailors. And all during these expeditions, you read about some of the sailors who decide, rather than go back to sea and face the trials and tribulations and giant, giant, giant waves in those rickety little boats, maybe they'll just stay on the island where they are with their new wife and, you know, coconuts and tropical paradise and everything else. Must have been an amazing period. You find out that there's this new giant area of land masses, continents that you didn't even know about. And the whole period right after Columbus is people going over to check out the new discovery, find out more about it, expand the maps. The Portuguese had done this along the Brazilian coastline. And Europe had a sort of attitude at the time that if you found it, it was yours. That is providing, of course, that you could wrest control of the territory away from the people that were already living there. That's sort of implied in the conquest. After all, the Europeans claimed a lot of land in what's now the modern Middle East and tried to enforce this claim during several crusades over hundreds of years, only to be thrown out of that area by the Islamic armies that were native there. So you can claim anything you want. If you can't back it up, doesn't mean anything. Of course, the difference was those Islamic armies had a similar level of military technology. When the early Renaissance Europeans arrive in the New World, it's like H.G. Wells' Martians from the War of the Worlds arriving in your community. The technological difference between the powers is hard to imagine. If I say things to you like the Zulus against the British, the Iraqis against the U.S. Army in the Gulf War, the Italians against the Ethiopians in the 1930s using poison gas on tribal natives, that doesn't convey the dominance. And it's amazing to think of the bravery of these natives going in and facing that level of disparity in military technology. Although the truth of the matter is that the Europeans who were busy destroying the native empires of Mexico while Magellan was crossing the sea were doing so with the help of thousands upon thousands of Native Americans as well. The tribes who were the victims of, you know, the right of the stronger, that same law the Europeans were basically using in their treatment of the New World, being used instead by one of the most ferocious imperialistic empires in all history, the Aztecs. And the fear that they engendered in their neighbors and the bitterness and the pent-up hatred came back to bite them when their neighbors sided with the equivalent of a bunch of white Martians who showed up on their shore to overthrow the Aztecs rather than uniting to toss out, you know, the newcomers. The right of the stronger was practiced in the New World before the Europeans ever got there as well. Now, while guys like Cortez and Pizarro, true conquistadores, were in the New World in order to, you know, overthrow empires and make war, Magellan was simply in the New World to get past the New World. He was in Brazil in 1519 looking for a way through Brazil to the other side. Magellan believed, as Columbus believed, and as many other navigators of his time believed, that that same theory that set Columbus on course in 1492 was still valid. Asia and all of its riches were nearby Europe to the west, just because Columbus had found that there was a giant landmass separating the two didn't invalidate that whole idea. Magellan believed if you could just get past the American continent, Asia was right on the other side. He even was supposed to have said in one of his business pitches for this expedition that he believed that Japan and Asia was right west of Mexico, right on the other side. The big problem, though, was how do you get to the other side? What expeditions there had been since Columbus had sort of explored the east coastline of Brazil and some of North America's southern eastern coast, and they were getting an idea of how big these continents were, and it was starting to look like it was very possible that there was no way through or around them, that the landmass extended all the way to the poles in the north and the pole in the south, and some of these Portuguese expeditions, for example, had gone as far south as they dared down the South American coast. You run into Arctic conditions down there, and they eventually had to turn around just assuming that the poles and the ice flows from the poles touch the landmass. There's no way around it. Magellan believed there was a way through it. He believed there was a waterway, a strait. And that's why he was in Brazil in 1519. I imagine his crew didn't care very much at this point, enjoying themselves with the locals, though, in a beautiful, unspoiled country. Must have been wonderful to see some of these places where, you know, modernity had not yet spoiled. Most of the writings from Magellan's expedition are dry, boring things by people keeping logs or information from inquests and investigations after the expedition was over, you know, trial type stuff. There was one Italian person who was with the crew. His name was Antonio Pigafetta, and he wrote a little bit more colorfully than the log keepers. And he talked about Brazil, sort of writing down a little bit about what the country was like. And back in Magellan's day, they didn't even have a name for Brazil. It was so newly found. It had a couple of different sort of nicknames it was going by. Nothing had taken hold yet. He referred to it by its most popular name at the time, Verzin. And here's what Antonio Pigafetta writes about going to Verzin when it was still unspoiled and fresh. Quote, "The said land of Verzin abounds in all good things, and it's larger than France, Spain, and Italy together. It's one of the countries that the King of Portugal has conquered. Its people are not Christians and worship nothing, but live according to the custom of nature, more like beasts than otherwise. And some of these people live 100 years, or 60, or 70 years or more, and they go naked, both men and women." He writes about the people in Brazil, quote, "Be it noted also that the inhabitants of this country, both men and women, are in the habit of painting themselves with fire all over their body and face. The men are shaved and wear no beard, for they pluck it out themselves, and their whole clothing is a ring surrounded by the largest parrot feathers, which they cover the part and backside only, which is a very ridiculous thing." He says almost all the men of this place, but not the women and children, have 3 holes in the lower lip, and wear small round stones about a finger in length hanging from them. And these people, both men and women, are not quite black, but tend to a tan color, and they openly display their shame, meaning their genitals, and they have no hair on any part of their person. Lawrence Berggreen, who wrote a great book about Magellan's expedition, fantastic, it's called Over the Edge of the World, quotes explorer Amerigo Vespucci, who saw this land of Verzin, Brazil, in 1502, 17 years before Magellan's people arrived, and he described it as a paradise. Here's what he wrote about it. He said, quote, "This land is very delightful and covered with an infinite number of green trees and very big ones, which never lose their foliage and through the year yield the sweetest aromatic perfumes and produce an infinite variety of fruit, gratifying to the taste and healthful to the body. And the fields produce herbs and flowers and many sweet and good roots, which are so marvelous that I fancied myself to be near the terrestrial paradise." Berggreen quotes Vespucci from another place where he points out that this was all known, you know, firsthand from his own experience. Vespucci writes, quote, "I tried very hard to understand their life and their customs, because for 27 days I ate and slept with them." He said of these natives, quote, "They have no laws or faith and live according to nature. They do not recognize the immortality of the soul, and they have among them no private property, because everything is common. They have no boundaries of kingdoms and provinces and no king! Exclamation point. They obey nobody. Each is lord unto himself. No justice, no gratitude, which to them is unnecessary because it is not a part of their code." And like all of the chroniclers from Europe who ran into the practice of cannibalism. Vespucci was really freaked out by the idea of people eating people. He writes, quote, "They are a warlike people, and among them is much cruelty. Nor do they follow any tactics in their wars, except that they take counsel of old men. And when they fight, they do so very cruelly. And that side which is lord of the battlefield bury their own, but the enemy dead they cut up and eat. Those whom they capture they take home as slaves, and if they're women they sleep with them, and if they're men they marry them to their girls. And at certain times, when diabolic fury comes over them, they sacrifice the mother with all the children she's had, and with certain ceremonies kill and eat them. And they did the same to the said slaves and the children who were born of them." Vespucci concluded, according to Lawrence Begrine, quote, "One of their men confessed to me that he had eaten the flesh of more than 200 bodies, and this I believe for certain," end quote. Pigafetta goes on to explain how the cannibalistic custom first began, the legend and the story, and then he says, quote, "They do not eat the whole body of the man taken, but eat it piece by piece. For fear that he be not tasted, they cut him up in pieces, which they put to dry in the chimney. And every day they cut off a small piece and eat it with their ordinary food to call to mind their enemies." End quote. You know, this element of the cannibalism, that it is somehow to punish your enemy or rub salt in the wounds or remind you of him, reminds me a lot about that custom from the Eurasian steppes, where the Scythians and the Sarmatians and the Huns and all those people would make drinking cups out of the skulls of their enemies. And some of the historians said the whole point of this was to sort of rub salt in the wounds, and you could even address the cup and look at it and say, "What were you thinking to go up against me?" or something like that. Seems a similar sort of a human reaction when you would be eating the flesh of one of your enemies. A way of saying, you know, just to remind you, you lost. But nothing freaked out the European sensibilities more than the idea of being eaten. And every now and then, in the same way a shark attack will freak people out about sharks for a long time, a cannibal attack will resonate and word would reach back into Europe and just sort of chill the bones of people who thought they might end up on islands that might possibly have people who might possibly eat people. One of the stories was translated into English in the 1500s. It's about an expedition that landed in Brazil only a few years before Magellan's, and it was so widely known that Magellan's crew even referred to the fact of this earlier expedition. They knew about it, and what had happened was, in 1515, there was an expedition of Portuguese down in what's South America now, very near where Magellan was, and they had seen natives on the coastline and sent out a shore party, and everybody seemed happy, and they were friendly, and then right before the eyes of the rest of the crew, not that far out to sea, here's what Richard Eden's translation from 1555 says happened. Quote, "Suddenly a great multitude of the inhabitants burst forth upon them and slew them every man with clubs, even in the side of their fellows, not one escaping. Their fury not thus satisfied, they cut the slain men in pieces, even upon the shore, where their fellows might behold this horrible spectacle from the sea. But they, being stricken with fear through this example, durst not come forth of their ships, or devise how to revenge the death of their captain and companions. They departed, therefore, from these unfortunate coasts, and returned home again with loss and heavy cheer." End quote. So essentially, these people killed, cut up, cooked, and ate the captain and some of the officers of these ships as the crew watched on. One can only imagine what that must have been like. It made an impression, and one of the reasons that Magellan's crew reacted in a very suspicious manner sometimes when they arrived on some of these coasts is, well, the incident I just related to you happened only 4 years before Magellan's expedition. Now, the fact that Magellan was even in Brazil with a Spanish fleet is a bit of a miracle and very controversial in and of itself. I can't imagine Magellan was really worried about the natives in these places, though. He had so many worries closer to home. You see, Magellan's Portuguese. And the Portuguese and the Spaniards in this period are not close. As a matter of fact, one author described their relationship as being very similar to that of the Soviet Union and the United States during the Cold War. Magellan's Spanish crew, it wasn't all Spanish, it was an international crew, but dominated by Spaniards, didn't like him just due to where he was from. Imagine a Soviet defector being put in charge of a real national security-oriented submarine mission, and how would his American crew feel about him? Maybe a little suspicious. Poor Magellan, though, people were just as suspicious of him in his own country, because now he's working with the other side. He's working with his own country's geopolitical rivals. And the King of Portugal was so mad at him, he was putting prices on his head to have him assassinated. He was bad-mouthing him. He was vandalizing the family's historic property in Portugal. He was sending out fleets to go intercept him. And yet Magellan had offered this whole deal to the King of Portugal first, and the King of Portugal said no. So he said, well, can I take it elsewhere? The King of Portugal says, I don't care what you do. So Magellan took it to the King of Spain, and then the King of Portugal got mad at him. So by the time Magellan's in Brazil, his crew hates him. The King of Portugal, his former sovereign's mad at him. Everybody wants him dead. The fact that Magellan had all these factors working against him before he even got started on maybe the most dangerous journey ever taken by people up to that point shows just how amazing a person he was. Magellan had already survived a mutiny on the way over. I mean, he'd hardly been gone from Spain 5 minutes, and his Spanish sub-captains, who didn't like him anyway and didn't trust him, tried to overthrow him. One in particular, a guy named Cartagena, or the Spaniards probably pronounced it Cartagena, tried to overthrow him and didn't have very much support. After Magellan leaves Rio, though, they go farther and farther into nasty weather conditions and cold climates, and they winter at a place called Port St. Julian, which is a really dreary place, sort of on the same north-south level as the Falkland Islands. And tensions boil over, and there's another mutiny, a really well-organized one involving several of Magellan's ships. And it collapses, too. The amazing thing about mutinies in the age of exploration is that you read about them all the time. The sailors must have been so fearful and so on edge all the time to be willing to risk the punishments that were given out in failed mutinies. I mean, for example, when the mutiny at Port St. Julian fails, Magellan holds a trial, and the first thing they do is that they actually try the dead body of the captain who died during the mutiny. He's found guilty, and they cut his remains up and draw and quarter him and spit him on the island on a gibbet. Sort of a message to everyone. Then they convict one of the other Spanish sub-captains, and they sentence him to have his head cut off. And in some weird sort of twist that makes no sense to me at all, they sentence his servant to death too, but then say that he can live if he'll be the one to cut his master's head off, which he agrees to do. We're told he asks his master, a guy named Quesada, for forgiveness before he does it, and is told no. Historian Samuel Eliot Morrison says that he then cuts his master's head off with relish. And so Quesada's body is left on Port St. Julian as well. Cartagena, another Spanish captain, a very powerful guy in Spain, is also involved in both mutinies, but is forgiven both times because he's powerful, is found to be conspiring a third time before the fleet even leaves Port St. Julian. Again, you wonder what these people were thinking. He can just look over the ship's side and see his two friends, you know, rotting on the beach there. So Magellan does something that was also big in the age of exploration. He maroons this guy along with a priest. To maroon someone is to simply leave them. And we're told that both the Spanish captain and the priest were kneeling at the water's edge, beseeching the ships not to leave and praying to God that, you know, they change their minds. As a matter of fact, 51 years later, the first British explorer to go around the world, Sir Francis Drake, would stop at this very same spot, Port St. Julian, to execute his own mutineer. And there were conflicting stories about how much of what Magellan left behind he found. Some stories say there were still bones and Spanish armor. Others say it was just the gibbet that the cut-up body of the Spanish captain had been displayed on. Eventually, Magellan will find his strait through the South American continent. There's all sorts of adventure and drama involved in doing so. If you go to Google Earth and you look down at the Strait of Magellan, you can see how many dead ends this maze-like natural waterway has in it. And they all had to be explored. Magellan lost one ship that broke up exploring some of this maze. He lost another ship, the one with all the provisions, when it decided to desert as soon as it got away from the main fleet. It headed back off to Spain, sure that Magellan and everyone on board his crew were dying. Truth be told, now that we look back on it. The people in the ship that turned around might have made the smart move. The three ships that made it to the other side of Magellan Strait, being the first Europeans to get to the Pacific Ocean and really sail in it, Balboa just saw it, when Magellan's people emerged from the strait, there it was, and it was a geographical feature that Magellan was completely unprepared for. This is where Magellan's expedition becomes one of the most fun in this whole era. Because, like all European maps, his was wrong. And a lot of the basic assumptions that these explorers had were based on maps that went all the way back to the Roman Empire. How bad do your maps have to be when you look at 800 and 900-year-old maps from Rome as improvements over what you have? You know, as the equivalent of finding, you know, treasure maps that are a millennia old that are going to give you the keys to the geographical kingdom. You see, those maps drawn up by guys like Claudius Ptolemy, those maps didn't show a Pacific Ocean. Neither did the more modern Spanish and Portuguese maps that were based on those earlier Roman maps. Here was Magellan with his belief that once he emerged from the strait, Asia would be close by, and he's got this giant body of water instead. And he still doesn't realize what he's dealing with. He's dealing with 63 million square miles of water. An ocean twice the size of the Atlantic. And the Atlantic had proved so daunting for all this time to Europeans. He was dealing with an ocean that was so large, you could fit the entire landmass of the planet, plus another Africa in it. And he didn't see land for the next 98 days. And the Pacific Ocean is so large, you could starve on the way across it, and his crew almost did. Antonio Pigafetta writes about, you know, how hard up for food they were during this voyage. Quote, "On Wednesday, the 28th of November, 1520, we issued forth from the said strait and entered the Pacific Sea, where we remained 3 months and 20 days without taking on board provisions or any other refreshments, and we ate only old biscuit turned to powder, all full of worms and stinking of the urine which the rats had made on it, having eaten the good. And we drank water impure and yellow. We also ate ox hides, which were very hard because of the sun, rain, and wind. And we left them 4 or 5 days in the sea, and then laid them for a short time on embers, and so we ate them. And of the rats, which were sold for half an ecu apiece, some of us could not get enough." End quote. What Pigafetta was saying is that along the route, the crew was starving to death. They were taking the protective leather ox hides from the masts, ripping them down, soaking them in seawater for a few days to make them soft enough to chew, putting them on the fire and eating that. They were eating leather. They were selling rats to each other as fresh food. And it's funny, I always think, why didn't they just fish? But the stories of crews starving to death at sea are so pervasive, there must have been something preventing, you know, such an easy solution. And if they didn't starve to death, they'd get scurvy. That disease you get when you don't get any vitamin C in your system for a long time. And it'll kill you. It killed almost 30 of Magellan's sailors crossing the Pacific. When he finally arrives at land, I mean, there's a couple of rocks he runs into first with no life and no food, but the first habitable place that can help his, you know, near-death crew is in the Marianas. It's modern-day Guam. And he gets there, and you have one of those encounters with the locals that just so wonderfully demonstrates the clash of cultures and how misunderstandings are absolutely unavoidable. When the natives from Guam sail out to Magellan's fleet with his debilitated sailors with no energy, lying around probably in a stupor, and they climb aboard his ship, they start taking stuff. Anything that they fancy, anything metal, anything pretty, just grab it, jump back over the side, get in your sailboat and go. And when you read the accounts of this incident, you get the feeling that this all happened very quickly. There's no communication at all, because apparently this is the first time the people in Guam had ever seen people from the outside world. And violence breaks out because at one point, one of the crew tries to prevent one of these natives from leaving with something important. Maybe a piece of navigational equipment, something that the crew may have needed to get home. And the accounts say that The European slapped the native, and the native slapped the European back, so the European pulled out a knife or a sword and stabbed the native. So things escalated. It turns out, though, that the people of this island came from a communal society, where simply walking up and grabbing something that was attractive to you would have been just fine. At the same time, they were taking stuff from the crew here. There were boats on the way out to the fleet with fresh food and water, and they were going to replenish the fleet. Magellan's crew named this island the Isle of Thieves. And author Lawrence Bergreen says they should have called it the Island of Sharers, because all they were communal folks with a live-and-let-live sort of attitude when it came to stuff. But it's understandable, once again, that violence would break out. Now, the level of violence that the Europeans showed is kind of one of those things that the people who would say that the Europeans are particularly evil or particularly different than other human beings, these are the kind of things they would point to. They would point to the fact that, you know, the Europeans would run into some of these natives. For example, they ran into some people they called giants in what's now Patagonia, another name that Magellan coined. You know, and they tricked one of them into putting on leg chains, and they captured him and took the Indian with them. When on the Island of Thieves in Guam, the natives had stolen the commander's little teeny boat and run away with it, Magellan gets a party of 30 or 40 sailors together. They land on the island, they burn about 50 huts, and they, you know, kill about 7 or 8 of the locals. It just seems disproportionate, and you wonder why they did it. Some people feel that they did it because Europeans, either racially or culturally, are just a bit that way. That's what they're like. They're violent and they're aggressive. Is that how our tannish descendants, or maybe how the aliens would see them when they're trying to understand humanity's past, maybe, say, the same way we would about one of the green aliens or the gray aliens, and say, oh, the gray aliens are the ones with the good sense of humor. Maybe the tannish descendants or the aliens will look back at our past and say, oh yeah, the white ones, they are the aggressive ones that like to colonize other people. Now, Magellan and his crew will next go from Guam, and they'll sail west. One wonders how they even knew where to go. Probably just in the opposite direction from where they were, because they have no idea where the Spice Islands are. They thought they were going to be right on the other side of Mexico. You sail 98 days and don't run into anything. You know, there was a point where even the true believer Magellan is said to have thrown his maps overboard and, you know, yelled in frustration, "My pardon to the cartographers, but the Moluccas are not in their appointed place." Gee, you think? Now, an interesting thing happens when the Armada de Malacca gets to the Philippines, and it's a sign that they are near their destination, and it's also proof of how far they've come. Magellan's slave, named Enrique, who was captured a little more than a decade before, a little west of this area, in the Indian Ocean area, he can understand the locals when they call out to Magellan's ships. The fact that Enrique, who speaks the Malay tongue, can understand the people in this area, and they can understand him, is a sign that Magellan has come so far west that he's arrived in the Far East area. Ironically, the slave Enrique may be the real first person to actually go all the way around the earth. Not just that, but the people in the Philippines are often extremely literate. You go all around the coast, they can all read and write. Once again, a sign that they've had intense contact with China. Some of these islands have had contact with Islamic folks, and you can see the advanced stuff around you, and their societies seem to be more old world in construction. You have kings and hierarchies and those sorts of things. But what that tells the Europeans is that Magellan has come all the way around to the other side of the known world. So Magellan has these adventures in the Philippines, and a lot of these adventures involve two things: religion and politics. The religion part has to be dealt with, but it's a very hard issue to quantify, and it's a hard issue to examine in this story. What role did Christianity play in all this time? Well, I'll leave it to more intelligent people than yours truly to figure this out. But when you watch a guy like Magellan or Pizarro or Cortez or these people, it's interesting to see the confidence they have, you know, at these really, really, really tense, unknown times. In Magellan's case, it's obvious that he is such a true believer, that he is under God's protection and that he's achieving his destiny and that nothing will be allowed to stand in the way of his destiny, he takes risks that are almost unimaginable. He closes his eyes and he just jumps at times, seemingly assured that nothing bad will happen to him. This is a wonderful quality, by the way, to have if you play Russian roulette for a living. To believe that your God will not allow you to end up pulling the trigger and getting the one bullet in the gun helps you do your job a lot. I mean, at one point when Magellan's converting this Philippine island, he shows his level of belief in his own protection because the island was told to throw away all of their pagan idols, which they apparently did for the most part. But then there's a story about one really sick man, and Magellan finds out that he's kept a couple of these idols hidden in the hopes that it'll help him recover from his sickness. And Magellan goes to him and the locals and says, throw away these idols, embrace the Christian religion, and you will recover. And if you don't, everyone here can cut my head off. You get the feeling the locals must have looked at each other and said, wow, this'll be a good test of his God. Imagine taking that chance. There must have been a few in Magellan's crew who supported some of the earlier mutinies who were hoping the guy wouldn't recover. But he did. Now, if Magellan didn't already have this belief that he was protected by a deity, he certainly had it afterwards, and it led to his death almost directly. He got involved in not just Christianizing the locals, but the politics, and the two were related because he would tell the Christian king, who he liked so much he made a blood brother of, that now that you're Christian, I will help you against your enemies. And he would say something like, well, who's your enemy? And he goes, well, I'm having problems with the guy on Mactan Island, the king of that island, and he's not Christian, and I'm having problems with him. And Magellan said, well, I'll go get him. And the king of the island he was on, the now Christian guy, said, well, we'll go with you, and we'll do it together. And Magellan said, nope, I want you to see how Spanish lions fight. And he took 60 of his own men, dressed them in the finest European armor, took the guns, the crossbows, the swords, has the Christian king bring all his men to watch, his native soldiers, invades Mactan Island, runs into Lapu Lapu, king of Mactan Island, and at least 1,000 warriors who proceed to tear the Europeans up. While Magellan's blood brother, Christian native king friend, and his troops watch, Magellan and his troops are pushed into the sea. Antonio Pigafetta was there fighting in the knee-deep water, who says, quote, those people, meaning the natives, shot at no other place but our legs, for the latter were bare, meaning it had no armor. Thus, for the great number of lances and stones, he says, that they threw and discharged at us, we could not resist. Our large pieces of artillery, which were in the ships, could not help us, because they were firing at too long range, so that we continued to retreat for more than a good crossbow's flight from the shore, still fighting, and up in water up to our knees. And they followed us, hurling poisoned arrows 4 or 6 times, while, recognizing the captain, Magellan, they turned towards him, and as much as twice they hurled arrows very close to his head. But as a good captain, and a knight, he stood fast with some others, fighting thus for more than an hour, and he refused to retire farther. An Indian threw a bamboo lance in his face, and the captain immediately killed him with his lance, leaving it in his body. Then trying to lay hands on his sword, he could draw it out but halfway, because of a wound from a bamboo lance that he had in his arm. Which seeing, all those people threw themselves on him, and one of them, with a large javelin, thrust it into his left leg, whereby he fell face downward. On this, all at once, all rushed upon him, with lances of iron and of bamboo, and with these javelins, so that they slew our mirror, our light, our comfort, and our true guide. Pigafetta may have been in the minority, being so distraught over Magellan's killing on that beach. It's been suggested that his crew may have actually sort of finally had their successful mutiny. They call it mutiny by inaction, allowing the natives of Mactan to do for them what they had failed at least twice to do themselves. Pigafetta says Magellan was looking back constantly to make sure his crew was getting away and were safe. These historians think he may have been looking back wondering where the help was to get him out of this jam. Now, while he may not have been that popular amongst his crew, Magellan has to rank as one of the great mariners of all time, if not the greatest mariner, and simply getting as far as he had gotten to the Philippines is an amazing feat. The Age of Discovery is full of a number of extremely interesting men. Magellan may be at the top of the list. The historian Samuel Eliot Morison quotes Edward G. Bourne, who said about Magellan, quote, "There was none of the prophetic mysticism of Columbus in the makeup of the great Portuguese. Magellan was distinctly a man of action, instant, resolute, enduring. The first navigation of the Straits of Magellan was far more difficult of a problem of seamanship than crossing the Atlantic. Columbus's voyage was over in 35 days, but Magellan had been gone a year and weathered a subarctic winter before the real task began, the voyage over a trackless waste of water exactly three times as long as the first crossing of the Atlantic. Magellan is to be ranked as the first navigator of ancient or modern times, and his voyage is the single greatest human achievement on the sea." End quote. Now, while the crew may have been kind of relieved that Magellan was gone, after all, they wanted to get to the Spice Islands and make their money. Magellan was the one who was on this evangelical crusade and getting involved in the internal politics of these islands. They just wanted to move on, find these islands, and get home, as most people would. They didn't believe they had this divine protection against that one bullet in the Russian roulette gun, and they felt like they'd had a lot of pulls of the trigger so far, and they were right to be fearful. In a funny way, Magellan's death opened the door up to another tragedy for the Armada de Malacca before they would even leave the Philippines. What happens is, after Magellan died, his slave, Enrique, the one who could speak the language of the locals, that's how they knew they'd gotten around the world, decided he was a free man. And it seems that by the terms of his enslavement, he was. Once Magellan was dead, Enrique was free to go. He wasn't going to work for the crew anymore. And the crew didn't like this. Obviously, he was their only connection to speaking to the locals. How were they going to get through the rest of their mission without being able to talk to the people of the Spice Islands or anywhere else? They said Enrique couldn't go. Enrique got really angry, stormed off the ship, went to the island, talked to that Christian king who was so close to Magellan, and apparently plotted a conspiracy. The king sent a message to the crew saying, "Hey, before you go, come on over to the island. Let's have one last feast." He'd given them a number of good feasts already. "And I have all those presents, those jewels and everything else that I said I'd send to the King of Spain. You come on over, pick them up, and we'll say goodbye the right way." Pigafetta says about 24 men, including the two new captains elected to replace Magellan, took the king up on his offer, went to his banquet, and sometime during the banquet, when no one was ready for it, sprang a trap on the sailors. As they ate and drank, his warriors attacked them, killed almost all of them. And the way Pigafetta found out about this is that he says they were in their ships. He'd been struck in the forehead by a poison arrow and his whole face was swollen and he couldn't go to the banquet. He said they heard a noise from shore, only to find that one of the two captains elected to replace Magellan was being held by the natives. And sounds like one of those scenes where they had a knife to his throat and he was screaming and crying out and saying, you know, "Do whatever you can to help me, ransom me, whatever." After a lot of negotiations and things break down and eventually the crew of the ship decides they have to leave. And this towering figure of the mariner is on the beach screaming and weeping and crying and saying he'll be killed the minute they leave. And then as he realizes they're leaving and his friend João Carvalho is one of the people in charge of the ships, he screams and says that in the afterlife he's going to demand Carvalho's soul in repayment for this. It's a very dramatic moment. Eventually, what's left of Magellan's crew will find the Spice Islands. They have to burn another one of their ships because they don't have enough men left to crew them all. But the two ships, Victoria and Trinidad, make it to the islands, which are close by to the Philippines, and they probably had someone at least point them in the right general direction. And when you think about it, the arrival of the Armada de Malacca, or what's left of it, in the Spice Islands is sort of the culmination of what a ton of people had already, you know, explored and risked life and limb and actually died trying to find. The Armada finds this place in the 1520s. In 1492, Columbus discovers America while looking for this place. In effect, a ton of the Age of Exploration was designed to get here. And these are the guys who first do it by sailing west, which was the original idea all along. How much must they have felt like they had dodged the bullets in that Russian roulette pistol up to this point? They had won the lottery. They had made it to the most valuable place on Earth. And there's nothing quite like the Spice Islands in terms of what it means to the planet and how valuable they are today. because the Spice Islands were the only place to get some of these spices. The best cloves, for example, and cloves were like the number one spice in the whole world at this time, and spice was like oil or gold, or if you wanted to think about something that, you know, the whole time I was reading about Magellan and the spice trade, it sounded like the modern day drug trade to me, only legal. The amounts of money that could be made, the dangers in getting the product from, you know, where it's made to where it's consumed, it sounded a lot like a legal version of what happens with drugs in the modern economy. There will be a wonderful story involving international intrigue and whatnot down the road where British, and I believe the French also, managed to steal some of the all-important seeds from the Spice Islands and take them to colonies that they've established in similar climates and break the monopoly of the Spice Islands later by growing cloves and nutmeg and cinnamon and all these important spices elsewhere. But at this time, if you wanted cloves, this is where you got them. Cinnamon, black and white pepper, same thing. The multitude of islands that comprise the Moluccas, and there's a bunch of them, but a couple of major big ones, 5-7 big ones, but all put together they wouldn't be the size of Cuba. And yet, they control the geopolitical outcome at this time period. If anybody controls this area, they have a stranglehold on world trade. And one of Magellan's selling points when he launched this expedition was telling the King of Spain that he believed, based on a treaty called the Treaty of Tordesillas, signed in 1494, that these valuable islands fell into Spain's zone of ownership, which is a weird thought when you think about it, because how can you own a place you don't even know how to find? The Treaty of Tordesillas by the Pope is a famous document which divides the world in half between the Spanish and the Portuguese. Weird already, because you wonder what all the other European Catholic powers thought of that. But nevertheless, because the Europeans had such poor map-making skills at the time, and because they didn't know, you know, had all these areas of the map that the Pope divided that you had just blank areas where you had no idea what was there, it's a little like being on the old game show Let's Make a Deal and choosing what's behind door number two. It's like the Pope says, here, I give you this half of the world, now go find out what you own. That's what a lot of these expeditions were, and according to Magellan, these Spice Islands were going to fall in the King of Spain's zone of control. That's quite a bombshell. It would be akin to telling a country today, oh, say the United States, that after new surveys, the Saudi Arabian oil fields actually fall into American territory. The Moluccas were the most valuable piece of property on a square foot basis in the entire Renaissance world. So the crews load their vessels up with this spice that's so pungent that they were able to smell these islands before they saw them. And they're just about to get underway when one of the ships, and there's only two left, springs a leak. And they can't go on. So they have this big meeting and decide what's going to happen. So they decide to take the one ship that's doing okay, the Victoria, laden with spices, and head on, you know, back to Europe, the traditional direction. The other one stays around and gets mended up. Here's the problem. Under the Treaty of Tordesillas, this whole route going back to Europe, this direction, is the Portuguese zone of control. And they're involved in that Cold War situation between Spain. And if the commander of the Victoria, the one ship that's seaworthy and heading back, his name is Juan Sebastian Elcano, or Del Cano, sometimes called, a Basque Spaniard sailor, he's leading this ship, he heads on back. If he gets caught by the Portuguese, they will likely kill him and the crew. Just won't even find the bodies. And to show how much of a threat they did face, the other ship will stay in port at the Spice Islands for a couple of months, mend up, get ready to go and be captured by the Portuguese. Most of those guys never made it back home. Elcano will guide the one ship left from the Armada de Malacca through pirate-infested waters, cannibal islands, the Indian Ocean, Portuguese, you know, fleets, and eventually get it back to Spain. And it must have been a sight to be there when it arrived, because we're told basically it's like a death ship with a few people alive, staggering into port, almost leaking so badly that they wonder how it doesn't just sink in the river by Seville. And that one ship brought enough cloves back to pay for the whole mission. And because the commander of that vessel was Juan Sebastian Elcano, a lot of Spaniards today feel that he's the guy who really went around the world first, not Magellan. The Basque Spaniard hero gets rewarded with another fleet by the King of Spain to go right back to where he'd just come from. And Elcano will lose his life on that expedition. Kind of proving my point that it's a little like Russian roulette, and you can only pull the trigger of that pistol so many times before your luck runs out. Antonio Pigafetta becomes immortal, writing about his experiences on the first circumnavigation of the globe. And he makes the point that now that they know how big the Pacific is, he doesn't think anyone will ever try to do this again. And it will be 60 years almost before it's successfully done again. Sir Francis Drake's voyage circumnavigates the globe in 1580. But that's a really long time in this fast-paced era of exploration. Magellan was far ahead of the pack in terms of exploring the world. But of course, it was sort of on false pretenses. He didn't know how far he had to go. Now, when you take Magellan, along with all the other Spanish and Portuguese explorers who are active at this time and soon afterwards, they're involved in literally resetting the world. The explorations and the discoveries and the lands that they will claim for Spain and Portugal, and later the lands that Britain, France, the Netherlands, and other countries will claim, will essentially inject steroids into Western Europe that will propel them to the top of the international food chain for 4 or 5 centuries. If you pull out a historical atlas from 1900 and you look at the world then, it's astounding how much of it, the vast majority, is controlled by a bunch of tiny little states on the periphery of the Eurasian landmass. What accounts for that? Well, everything those little tiny maritime states were able to, you know, garner from this wild period of exploration that probably should have gone to the Chinese or the Arabs or some other people. Jared Diamond's wonderful book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, was written to answer the question of a native person who asked the author why it was that it was the Europeans who ended up with all, he called it cargo, all the stuff that allowed them to do all this. Why did they have the guns? Why did they have the armor? Why did they have the technology? Why did they have the explorers? You know, why did they have everything else that it took to do this? Why did it go to the white folks instead of some other civilization? And why did the really virulent diseases all go from the old world to the new world instead of the other way around? Those are the kind of things Diamond's book tries to answer. I mean, just think of how different history would have been if the Europeans came to the New World and they got a bunch of terrible diseases, took them back to Europe, and 2/3 of the population in Europe died. Diamond determined, and his theory is the one I like the best, that a bunch of events, everything from the domestication of animals to the kinds of agriculture that were being done thousands of years before this period, created what amounted to kind of a perfect storm right around, you know, the time of Henry the Navigator and Columbus and those people, allowing the Europeans a chance to dominate the world for half a millennium. And it's ironic that the earliest countries in on this, the Microsoft and the Apple, if you want to call it that, at the age of exploration, are the first ones to fade. Spain and Portugal's empires will be essentially through in the 1800s, except for a few small places. Britain, France, the Netherlands, Belgium, those places lasted longer, but the First and Second World Wars were the, you know, first nails in the coffin of their colonial empires. One might make the case that places like the United States, herself a colonial possession of Great Britain and France and Spain at one time, is coming off of its steroid highs too. Jared Diamond's historical haves and have-nots is mutable and changes. Our tannish descendants, studying this history 1,000 or 2,000 years from now, will see the age of exploration all the way to the Second World War as practically a historical blink of an eye. 400 or 500 years of dominance by a single race of people or a single civilization is not unusual. And for the people who would suggest that there was something special about the Europeans that allowed them to do this, everyone from the Kipling era people who would suggest that it was something intrinsically better about white civilization or the white race, all the way to the people who would suggest that there was something intrinsically unhealthy and nasty about the white race, has to sort of deal with the question, though, why is this something that only manifested itself 400 or 500 years ago when the age of exploration started? Where was all this superiority, if you're a Kipling type, or inferiority and nastiness, if you're a revisionist historian, where was all of this early on? Because really, if you look at the places that benefited the most from the age of exploration, whether it's Spain, Portugal, France, Britain, Belgium, the Netherlands, none of these places really ever had a place in the sun before. It may have been their turn. And we may be witnessing now and transitioning to a change in the historical fortunes. I always think of nations and civilizations getting their place in the sun as a little like being awarded the Olympics. And some places are big upsets and never get the Olympics, and maybe that's Western Europe. And then some places seem to get the Olympics every second or third time, you know, the games are awarded to someone. And to me, we may be seeing things transition back towards one of those traditional powers that often gets a chance to be one of the lead dogs in the center stage of the historical circus, China specifically, and Asia in general. And if that's the case, somewhere down the road, people are likely to look at the era of European colonialism as unfair for the people who lived through it, but perhaps fair in the grand scheme of things when history is looked at in its entirety. Maybe they'll look back on it as the time when Europeans had their day in the sun. Judging from human history, it may be a long time before they get their next chance.
For Hardcore History t-shirts or other merchandise, go to dancarlin.com.
Thanks to everyone for posting comments about the show on iTunes. They help get the program noticed.